This is Common Threads, an interfaith dialogue.
Fred Stella, President of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. For at least the last decade, we've been hearing about how the country is so polarized. During this time, I've heard a number of rather naive optimists trying to offer bromides about how we still have much more in common than we are likely to admit. While most of us do share a common language, a common history, and many traditions as well, this means little when one side has made an art of dehumanizing the other, incubating in hate, brainwashed by power brokers who make their fortunes by fomenting rage and suspicion of anything or anyone that is seen as dissenting. Well, today we're going to discuss this challenge, and in particular, what people of faith can do about it. We'll look at a new book, The Church's Mission in a Polarized World, by Father Aaron Westman. Let me share a little bit about Father Westman. He is Vicar General and Director of Formation of the Glenmary Home Missioners. He has a PhD from the Catholic University of Louvain in Belgium in systematic theology. He serves as an at-large board member for the Conference of Major Superiors in Men Religious and is a guest lecturer at St. Menrad Seminary and School of Theology. Glenmary, the religious congregation he belongs to, is a missionary society of apostolic life of the Catholic Church. Glenmary conducts mission in rural, poor, and non-Catholic areas of the United States, primarily in the Southeast and Appalachia. You can visit glenmary.org for more information. So we welcome to Common Threads, Father Aaron Westman. Hello, Father.
Hello, Fred. Thank you so much. It's really great to be here with you on the show.
Certainly. Glad to have you. You know, I mentioned here in the introduction that a lot of people have been soft selling this terrible divide that we have in the United States for quite a while. And while I've always been hopeful that they were right and I was wrong, over the last couple of years, it has grown so significantly, this chasm that we have in the country, that I'm sorry to say that I'm right. I kept seeing it inch up little by little by little. When did you realize that we were headed in this direction?
Yeah, thank you so much for the question. So my religious community, the Glenmary Home Missioners, actually asked me to go over to Europe and study at the Catholic University of Louvain from 2014 to 2017 or 18. And during that period, I was outside of the United States and kind of investing myself, if you will, in European culture and in investigating what was going on there and kind of loving living in the European system. And I was really removed from kind of what was taking place in the United States at that time. So I kind of had a little bit of a reprieve, if you will, from the cultural and political situation in the United States. And then my community invited me to come back to the United States around 2017 and 18. And I just have to say that when I came back to the U.S., it became immediately evident to me that something had changed. And I began to see, I think, in a very significant way, that cultural polarization had intensified. There was an intensification of the negativity, the vitriol that was existing, the way people were kind of treating each other, left against right and right against left. I saw and heard from ministers that I knew and friends of mine that were priests, and they said, man, we're just struggling in our parishes, in our churches to kind of hold together congregations because, in a sense, the political divides had kind of, you know, put themselves deep into their churches and folks at times were leaving, they were fighting, they were struggling. I also saw, you know, within my own family, you know, where perhaps in the past, with loved ones or extended family, we could have conversations around politics or, you know, important values and important ideas. It was so difficult to do so. And it was such a kind of a reality check for me at that moment coming back in. And I always joked to people, I said, oh, you know, felt like I could kind of stay above the fray. And, you know, I had studied in Europe, you know, I was sophisticated and all that. And I noticed that, like, the intensity of the negativity sort of pulled me in. And I found it even kind of inside of myself. And I found myself, you know, getting really enraged if this or that politician would speak, or, you know, even with this or that political, this or that ecclesial figure speaking, I could feel myself getting upset inside. And I was just wondering right away, what in the world had happened and what had changed? And so I started to investigate polarization and try to figure out what had happened in the United States and what was happening within me.
Now, I have to admit something. When I was approached to interview you by your by your PR representative, she sent me an email and it explained the book, and I was ready to dismiss it almost immediately. And I'll tell you why. Because so many of thought leaders, politicians, and even people in the religious community tend to create what I consider to be a false dichotomy. Now, maybe I'm wrong, but I believe it's a false dichotomy. That is to say, and you just said it a couple of minutes ago, that yes, there is blame to go on the right and there is blame to go on the left. However, I genuinely believe that there is much more responsibility to be given to people on the extreme right. And there are more people, I believe, who are on the extreme right than there are on the extreme left. But the reason that I decided, okay, I'm going to give this a shot, is because your publicist has been so responsible for many, many wonderful guests on this program. And I thought, okay, if she says this is a book worth considering, I'm going to do that. And so I told her to send me the book. And I was pleasantly surprised that in your book, I believe it's in the fourth chapter, you sort of go ahead and say, yeah, while there are issues on the left, boy, the GOP really has done a number on the way things are in this country. And at that point, I go, okay, I'm reading the whole thing. And I'm gonna have Father Westman on our program today. I mean, here's the thing. We can certainly debate so many of the questions that are traditionally left and right. Are we going to tax the rich, or are we going to cut taxes across the board? Are we going to, is this particular environmental regulation too onerous, or is it not strong enough? Those are great questions to have. What about the state of education? Yes, should there be charter schools? Should we fund religious schools? I'm happy to have all of those conversations. But the conversations that keep coming up really frustrate me, and I suspect that they frustrate you, that we're talking about critical race theory that isn't even taught in grade schools, high schools, or colleges unless you go to law school. The various racial issues that are brought up, the red herrings that are brought up, and the dehumanization that people like Newt Gingrich they've turned it into an art form. So I'm going to hand it over to you at this point, and help me out here.
Yeah, so you're raising some really important points and some really important questions. And the one thing that I do try to do as best as I can in the book that I wrote is to try to approach it without attaching myself to one political party or the other. Particularly as a Catholic priest, my role is, in a sense, to serve all the people, whether that's in my parish or within a geographical territory where I've been assigned for my community. And so I sort of feel that kind of special connection to try my best to sort of bridge the gap between a person that might be on the left or on the right. And so that was my concern, particularly in writing the book, to sort of say, you know, how can I sort of speak to people on both sides? And one of the things I first tried to do is really rather than sort of assigning blame to, one particular party or one particular group, I sort of tried my best to invite us to ask the deep questions personally. So I think I invite us to a kind of examination of conscience. And I'm particularly asking people in the church to sort of say, based on my own actions in my own life and based on my own political involvement, how have I contributed to divisions, or how have I intensified the situation of polarization? And I really ask people to kind of ask those tough questions. And so in a sense, it's inviting all of us to kind of really look personally at ourselves, because I think that one of the ways in which we can start to overcome some of the negativity and some of the polarization that exists is really by doing a lot of introspection. Because I do think that when we live in a polarized society, we're all affected by that logic and that by that us versus them mentality. And I think, the work of Ezra Klein, for instance, the work of Liliana Mason and Amy Chua and their kind of research that they've done, they really do a good job in showing that, all of us have to kind of work towards, doing the best to not be overcome by polarizing tendencies. And that is the us versus them mentality, because that us versus them mentality is actually something that's sort of written into us as human beings. And that is, when we form groups, it's almost kind of like the default position for us to create in comparison to us. And in some sense, we see the them as an enemy. We see them as a threat. So we want to protect ourselves and kind of do whatever we can to sort of perhaps even in harm the other. So just to say that in speaking, I think the best thing for us to do is to sort of ask those critical questions of ourselves. Now, I think there are specific questions, related to, different parties and different politicians that we have to look at. And one of the things that I do in the book is take a long look at what we would call the culture wars or the culture war mentality. And I think it is well-researched and well-documented that the culture war metaphor and the culture war mentality, as I call it, did originate in the conservative mega group in the Republican Party, as you mentioned, with Newt Gingrich and Patrick Buchanan and others who began to kind of use this language and use this metaphor, and they brought it in within their political rhetoric. And then what I show in the book is that kind of slowly and perhaps even like secretively or insidiously, that culture war mentality was sort of brought into the Christian world and assumed by Christians. And what I tried to show in the book is that that became quite detrimental for the church to sort of view her way of existence or her way of being, or for Christians to view their discipleship, if you will, through the lens of the culture war. And the reason that I, try to show that that's problematic is, of course, that, I think the task of Christians is to really be about crossing over to and engaging with the other, about trying to enter into deep conversations with the other, even when there are disagreements, no matter who that other is, whether it's our political or racial or geographic or demographic other, whatever that might be. I think inherent in Christianity, we can talk more about this, is this whole logic of crossing over to the other, to engage the other, because that's ultimately what Jesus did in order to bring about salvation. So that's in a stark contrast to the war mentality that sees the other as the enemy, where I need to destroy the enemy and keep distance between myself and the enemy, or lob verbal bombs, if you will, at the enemy. Now, that being said, I do show in the book that this war metaphor, this war mentality, is being utilized currently today by both people on the left and the right. And I think it's problematic for us in our political discourse, in our civil discourse, and especially in our ecclesial discourse, which, church members, of course, would be the main audience of the book that I wrote.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Common Threads on WGVU. I'm Fred Stella. With me today, Father Aaron Westman. He is the author of The Church's Mission in a Polarized World. Interesting, you're talking about war as metaphor. Do you remember who Wesley Clark is?
I do not know who that is.
Okay, he is a retired admiral. And
okay,
he threw his hat in the ring to run for president years ago, and that hat remained in the ring for, if memory serves, about 5 minutes, which is why you don't remember who he is.
Okay.
But he's a remarkable person, and I happened to see him speak a couple of years ago, and he said that he was giving a speech on war strategy years ago, and Gingrich was there, and he came up and he applauded Wesley, and he said that what he learned from him was a great strategy to use on political opponents. And
yes.
Clark was kind of taken aback, like, wait, I'm talking about, like, killing people, right? And, you know, people who mean to do us terrible harm, and you're thinking about Democrats? So anyway, I completely get that. And I did not mean to indicate that the left, people on the left, are blame-free. Not at all. I just think that it is a bit heavy-handed. And again, as I mentioned, I think that when we say people on the right and people on the left, you know, there's obviously a middle point, and the people who control the narrative for the right, I believe, are further right. The people who control the narrative for the left, I believe, are closer to the center. And that's just me. But I want to ask you about, when you talk about crossing over, you're talking about engaging people with a different either political or social or spiritual point of view. And I'm wondering, do you mean crossing over purely one human being to another on all other matters, or are you talking about engaging in specifically dialogue, political, social, or religious dialogue? And what I mean by that is, I know several people who are much further to the right from that center point that I can engage with as human beings, and I can love, and I can appreciate their presence on Earth. But I would never think of engaging in a political discussion with them, because we don't share the same foundational reality. You know what I mean? It's kind of like if you were going to argue with, say, a Protestant, and I doubt you're very argumentative on this point, but if you were going to get into a debate, let's say on the real presence in the Eucharist, you would draw from the Bible. The Protestant would also draw from the Bible, because you have a common foundational reality. You agree on the veracity of the Bible. You interpret it differently. I think the biggest challenge is acknowledging that common foundational reality, that the two sides are very challenged in that. What I call reality and someone else on the far right calls reality are just two different things. Do you get that? Do you understand that that's a challenge?
So you're touching on issues that are related to why it's so difficult for us to overcome some of the negative tendencies in polarization, and why some of our discussions and our differences and some of the disagreements are so intractable. So I just would say a number of things, I think, about what you mentioned. So first of all, I was amazed looking at the research on polarization and some of the psychological and sociological research that talked about contact theory, which is just simply the idea that by being around people who are different than us, that is essentially the best way for us to kind of lessen the biases or the prejudices that we have against those people. And as I sort of thought about that idea, that whole idea of just simply kind of being around or living around or even just like associating, right? You don't have to have a necessarily deep conversation, but simply kind of being in the presence of them and sharing like the same space and even the same home, that can in itself help us already kind of to see their humanity, to see that we might even have things in common. As I looked at Christianity and Christian sources, whether it was the saints like St. Francis or St. Thomas Aquinas or Dorothy Day, And as I looked at the person of Jesus himself, I saw people who kind of lived contact theory, if you will. For instance, Jesus, he would see the demoniac or the so-called sinner of society or the leper or even the, you know, the religious leaders who disagreed with him. He would see them and he would cross over to them. He was, in a sense, engaging in contact theory. He was getting to know them. He was living around them. And of course, as we know, some of them didn't want him around. Some of them, in a sense, wanted to bring about his death. So there was always that threat there in a sense of trying to engage with the other. Now, it's interesting that there are a lot of examples given to us of the present day of people who actually did choose to cross over to people you would think would be impossible to engage with, to meet, to become friends with, and to dialogue with. For instance, I document in the book a man named Daryl Davis. Daryl Davis is a black man, and he has kind of spent his life crossing over to the Ku Klux Klan. And, you know, he will go to their rallies. They will scream negative things toward him. Sometimes, you know, it'll seem like his life is being threatened, but he will like hang in there. He will remain there. And he slowly builds friendships with people who are at these gatherings. And as Davis will say, and as stories on Davis will document, over 200 leaders of the Klan have left the Klan because of Davis's willingness to cross over. Now, are there kind of foundational vocabularies and philosophies and ideas shared between a Klan member and Daryl Davis? I'm not sure, but interestingly, by engaging with the other, one can discover whether or not there are some ways to actually talk about something that which is important. There are ways to build friendships. And sometimes what's really necessary is to begin by sharing one's story. And I think we can all understand and relate to another person's story in as much as it's their experience. It's their story, right? And from that story, we can sort of build out from there and start asking about important questions and differences and so on and so forth. And there really can be a change of heart. Now, you're right. I very much agree that it's very difficult, first of all, when we don't have a shared vocabulary, when it doesn't seem like we have, you know, cultural similarities and backgrounds that are similar, so we can use those as kind of bridges, right? So we can use them as bridges in building that relationship. But with that, I do think it is possible to engage with people that are quite different than us, but we have to use prudence. There will be some people that it is just not safe for us to engage with, and it might not be necessary or even a good thing for us to do so.
No, that's wise advice, of course. And aside from your subchapter on Daryl, I also appreciate the portion that you wrote about your colleague, another clergy member from your order who goes to Protestant churches and engages with them as well. Tell us his story.
So Brother Craig Digman is a member of the Glenmary Home Missioners, the community I belong to. And Glenmary's history and charism is that we go to very rural areas throughout the United States where there is less than 0.5% Catholic population. Now, we are a Catholic religious community going to counties where there are very few Catholics. So the majority of people that we engage with in the counties where we serve are typically non-Catholic Christians, so Protestants, usually Southern Baptists, Pentecostals, Assembly of God. And then there are also a lot of people that just don't belong to kind of any church background or any religious background. So one of the ministries of Glenmary is to engage in ecumenism. And Brother Craig has a kind of a unique position in engaging in ecumenism. He will go into a county and he will visit every single church that exists in that county. And all of them, normally except for maybe one, are Protestant churches. And, you know, so he will show up, he will start meeting people, he will say hi, he'll let them know, you know, I'm a Catholic religious brother, I just want to be here with you all, to spend time with you, to pray with you. And it's amazing how his very presence with them elicits questions, allows for deeper conversations, and they start to see, you know, that I can actually talk to this Catholic brother, we can recognize in a sense that we share some things together as Christians, and they, in a sense, begin to welcome him into their community kind of as one of their own. And it's really just a remarkable thing, because oftentimes he's the very first Catholic they've ever met in their entire lives. And they just kind of love getting to know him, and he loves getting to know them, because he grows from that relationship. And he would even say that his own practice of Catholicism is enhanced and animated by his relationships with these Protestants, with these non-Catholic Christians. And so it's really a ministry of crossing over to the other, engaging in conversation, remaining curious with the person that he's talking to, you know, remaining open for, as he says, kind of what the Spirit might do in those situations, and being willing to grow himself in that process.
And briefly, because we only have just a minute left, the population that he invests himself in, are they mainly just ignorant of Catholicism, or is there an actual anti-Catholic bias that sort of runs through the community before he gets there?
Yeah, so I think the rural communities where Brother Craig serves do have a mixture of some kind of just unfamiliarity or ignorance of Catholicism. They've just never had the opportunity really to be around Catholics, because there's so few in the county. And then there also will sometimes exist a long history of anti-Catholic bias or prejudice. And so when that is encountered, it can be very difficult, no doubt about it. But that's kind of one of the tasks of Glenmary in general, but also Brother Craig's ministry in particular, is to try to kind of, you know, do away with some of those prejudices or biases, and show the people, you know, that this is kind of an example of who a Catholic is, and we're here to sort of stand in solidarity with you and to love you as best we can.
Wonderful. Well, Father Westman, we're out of time for this episode of Common Threads, but we have many more questions. I hope that you'll be able to join us next week.
Thank you, Fred. I look forward to it.
You've been listening to Common Threads on WGVU. I'm Fred Stella, and with me today, Father Aaron Westman, the author of The Church's Mission in a Polarized World. Please join us again here next week on WGVU.
Common Threads is a production of WGVU in cooperation with the Interfaith Dialogue Association. The views and opinions expressed are not necessarily those of the station, its underwriters, or Grand Valley State University. In many cases, the participants on this program represent themselves and may not be designated spokespeople for the faiths they represent. Send questions and comments by email through our website, www.interfaithdialogueassociation.org. Thank you for listening, and join us again next week for another edition of Common Threads. This is Common Threads, an interfaith dialogue.
Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. Last week, we began our conversation with Father Aaron Westman. He is the author of The Church's Mission in a Polarized World. Let me tell you a little bit about Father Westman. He is Vicar General and Director of Formation of the Glenmary Home Missioners. He has a PhD from the Catholic University of Louvain in Belgium in systematic theology. He serves as an at-large board member for the Conference of Major Superiors of Men Religious and is a guest lecturer at St. Menrad's Seminary and School of Theology. Glenmary is the religious congregation he belongs to. It's a missionary society of apostolic life of the Catholic Church. Glenmary conducts mission in rural, poor, and non-Catholic areas of the United States, primarily in the Southeast. You can learn more about his mission at glenmary.org. We welcome Father Westman back to Common Threads. Hello, sir.
Hi, Fred. Thank you so much for having me.
Certainly, certainly. So last week, we talked about the very serious polarization that we're experiencing in the United States. Political parties that won't even talk to one another on so many very important issues. Holding the banner high of oftentimes no compromise. And I remember we were talking about Newt Gingrich last week, and I recall him just saying that loud and firm, no compromise, when the Republicans took over the House. Obviously, it's very challenging to have a working government when one side refuses to compromise with the other on any of so many important points and in legislation. We also talked a little bit about the challenge of identifying too strongly with a political movement in the context of one's religious association. And today I'd like to get more into the weeds on that, if you don't mind. So my first question is, let's talk about the challenges within the Catholic Church, because there really does seem to be a very strong divide between liberal Catholics and conservative Catholics. And I'm wondering if you have any experiences that you can share in dialoguing within that framework.
Yeah, it's a great place to start. So I appreciate the question. And, you know, obviously, I'm a Catholic priest, and, you know, my identity is within the Catholic Church. And this is something which is very special to me. You know, I find that the Church is the thing which gives me life and meaning and purpose. And so I kind of, you know, I tread lightly, and I recognize that this is very important and special for a lot of other people, too. So with that being said, I think it's important for the Church to take a very honest assessment of how she's living out her discipleship and her faith in Jesus. And so sometimes I think that requires sort of taking a very, you know, a somewhat critical look at how things are going and examining one's conscience. And so one of the things that I try to do in the book is to kind of take a look at the statistics around who's sort of occupying the Catholic Church. And, you know, Pew Research has put out a number of different surveys and things like that, and documented the different research on Catholicism. And what we see is that both political parties are, you know, represented with about the same percentage within the church. And so you have something like 45-47% Democrat, 45-47% Republican within the Catholic Church. And, you know, on the one hand, I think one can say there, well, there's a kind of good diversity of thought within the church, and people are trying to navigate you know, political issues and very kind of pragmatic policy issues, which is oftentimes kind of a difficult thing to do across the board in many ways. But one of the things I do try to invite the church to look at is that in as much as our political groups are operating under the logic of polarization, that same logic will be threatening itself to work its way out within the church. And so if partisans are polarized and those partisans occupy the church, then there's going to be kind of what I say is the metaphor of two swirling hurricanes within the church herself. And so I think the church has to kind of be aware that that tension exists. And I think you can see, you know, statistically, again, if you look at Catholicism, that people oftentimes will identify more closely with the values of their political party rather than with the values, or if one might say that the teachings or the doctrines of the church. And so you can kind of see there that there's an outsized or exaggerated influence of one's political party to the detriment of, you know, what one is sort of in a sense asked to kind of receive through the Gospels and through the tradition of the church. And so that's certainly a challenge, I think, within Catholicism, to recognize, one, that there's these hurricanes can be swirling around, and two, that oftentimes Catholics are identifying more closely with their political party than they are with what is the gospel message as understood by Catholicism.
You just mentioned the hurricane. That is a theme that runs through the book. Tell us about how a particular hurricane influenced you to some degree in this book, in writing this book?
So I actually come from Minnesota, and we don't have a whole lot of problems with hurricanes in Minnesota, thankfully. But I was assigned as a pastor to a Glen Mary mission out in eastern North Carolina, and that was where I had the opportunity to experience my first hurricane, which was a very scary and very real event, and it was something that nothing in the Midwest that I experienced before could ever kind of help me prepare for such an experience, and that was the experience of Florence. And so, you know, one of the things I try to do in the book is to show that, in as much as a hurricane forms by, you know, the accumulation of moisture and heat and intensity, one can kind of liken that to the formation of our sort of polarized groups in the United States, where they're sort of sorting around geographical areas, and within those kind of geographical sorting is also then political and identity sorting, religious sorting, and racial sorting. And this is happening as we talk about sort of the urban and the rural divide, the coastal divide, and the heartland divide. And so we have like two massive hurricanes now forming over the United States, and they're intensifying. And there's a lot of negative interaction between those hurricanes. And so I play on that metaphor throughout the book, which is a very real experience that I had in eastern North Carolina.
You tell a story of a time of panic where people were stocking up on goods, and you were at a store, and something about a woman trying to reach a can, if memory serves, and you didn't help her, and you felt bad afterwards. Tell me again just exactly what she was trying to do. She was trying to grab a can, and you didn't help her. Why?
Yeah, so I was preparing for the storm, trying to get provisions, as all of the local people told me to do, because you never know how long you're going to be without power and without being able to get to the store. So I went into one of the, you know, the local Walmarts, and I walked in there, and it was just like absolute pandemonium, panic, crises. And, you know, people were running in every direction, and they were grabbing stuff off the shelves. And what I found was the logic of that panic and the emotions around what was taking place, in a sense, sort of subsumed me into them. And all of a sudden, I felt my own heart palpitating. I started to kind of panic myself. And I said, you know, am I going to have enough supplies? Am I going to have enough water? Am I going to find toilet paper? We all know about that, of course, after the pandemic. And, you know, so all of a sudden, I'm running through the store. I'm putting things in my cart. And there's a woman there, and she's kind of reaching for something, an item on the top shelf. And she sort of looks at me. She makes eye contact. And as I say, not one of my most virtuous moments, I just walk on by. And it was just a little bit after that where I stopped in the store. I'm just like, you know, this is not who I am. I'm assuming this is not who all these people are either. And I asked the question, you know, what in the world is going on? What happened? And one of the things I try to do there is to sort of say that when we look at the polarized situation in the United States, there are a lot of ways that we are being influenced without us knowing that. And there's a lot of research done in social psychology and evolutionary psychology that indicates that when we form a group, what happens is almost unconsciously, we start to create an us versus them mentality to anybody outside of that group, because that's sort of built deep within our brains, right? There are mechanisms in our brains that if we feel our group being threatened in any way, our brains kind of turn on a switch. We start to experience stress. And what we want to do is protect our group and, in a sense, kind of harm the outside group. And so that is oftentimes what is triggered within us in a polarized situation, because we have the formation of two massive groups here in the United States, the left versus right, if you will. But all of these groups actually subsume our most important identity markers. And so what we see is it's not just our kind of political group that's threatened, but it's all of our other identities, right? So it's my racial identity, my religious identity, it's my cultural identity, my geographic identity. And I don't see that identity necessarily when I look across at the other group. And so that group seems like an even greater threat. And that, again, triggers that mechanism in our brain even more. And so all of a sudden, we start doing things that we're not even, in a sense, aware that we're doing. We're getting upset, our heart's palpitating, just like mine did as I was in that Walmart that day trying to get provisions for the hurricane.
You know, I'm not a betting man, usually, but I think I would bet a substantial amount of money that when that episode happened, you in the Walmart, the craziness, the woman,
yeah,
I'll bet you weren't wearing your collar.
That's very good. If I recall correctly, I was not.
No, you weren't.
Just coming back from a retreat.
No, I suspect that if you were wearing your collar, you might have reacted slightly differently. Is that a possibility?
You know, I hope so. I hope so. But it's very interesting, is it, when those stressors are turned on, when those triggers happen, in a sense, we can set aside, you know, let's say our better nature and do things that we would rather not do, for sure.
Yeah, well, clearly that's exactly what you did.
Yep.
But what I'm saying is that all of a sudden it's not just you, you're representing the whole Catholic Church at that moment. So
that's right.
That's why I'm thinking maybe if you had your collar, you would have reacted a little bit more like you want to. Would have wanted to react.
Sure hope so, absolutely.
I want to mention right now, if you're just tuning in, that you're listening to Common Threads here on WGVU-FM. I'm Fred Stella, and I'm speaking with Father Aaron Westman today about his book, The Church's Mission in a Polarized World. You know, you were just talking about multiple identities, and it occurred to me when I read this in your book that back in the day, people received their identity, now they seek it. I never heard growing up, even as a young adult and older adult, I never heard people say, I identify as blank. It's just, this is what I am. This is what has been handed down to me. And now we have this freedom, if you will, to actually choose just exactly how we want to be identified. We can take some, we might be made up of multiple ethnicities, but we want to identify, we choose to identify as this and that. And certainly there are many more sexual identities that are up for grabs as opposed to, you know, I am this, I am that. Now we choose to identify. And I recall one issue back in the day, you don't hear it as much anymore, but back in the 80s, there was this antagonism directed towards what are called hyphenated Americans. That mm-hmm. is anyone who chooses to put another ethnicity or land of origin next to their name, whether they came from Japan and wanted to call themselves Japanese American, or somebody who's a third generation Irish and wants to call themselves Irish American, as if there was the possibility of a dual loyalty. But quite frankly, mm-hmm. I just think it's realistic. My goodness, if you come from Japan or your parents come from Japan, you continue to visit Japan, you speak Japanese, you cook Japanese. You're a Japanese American. You know, I never quite understood how people were criticizing that. But talk about how this idea of choosing our identities might contribute to the clash that we have, the cultural clash.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a theme that's really important to me, and I find a lot of interest in it. And I following the work here of a philosopher by the name of Sigmund Bauman and also Francis Fukuyama, along with Charles Taylor, and they all argue in their own ways that one of the markers of the kind of the present age or the current age in which we live is that our identities are, in a sense, kind of fragile. So as you mentioned, kind of in a previous era, let's say, you know, 200, 300 years ago, if our identity was like an ice cube, we would stand very firm on that ice cube. We knew who we were, right? We received our identity from our family, from the location where we lived, from the profession that existed within our family, from the religious tradition that was handed on to us. And all this was handed on to us. It was very solid, and it just very infrequently changed. People didn't move. They didn't change professions. Families were a little bit more stable. There wasn't a lot of religious switching, if you will. You just kind of were what was given to you by tradition and by your family. Well, as you move into the modern era, Sigmund Bauman would say we live in what's called liquid modernity, and that ice cube today is, in a sense, been melted. And there are all kinds of reasons why this has taken place. Part of it is technological changes, which then just bring about change. Part of it is that people move, of course, today a lot more than they ever did before. We have all of these options available, which is sociologically called pluralization, right? So we have, you know, we could go on the internet and we can investigate any number of thousands of like philosophical or religious or other types of traditions, and we can kind of choose and put these together in any way that we want. So our identity is not just handed on to us, it's not given. And in one sense, that's a benefit on the one hand of the modern era, so that, you know, because there are maybe some unhealthy things which are handed on to us, let's say by our families or, you know, particularly by the geographical place maybe where we come from. So we have an opportunity to sort of reject that and choose something different. But what some of these other philosophers, especially Bauman, will highlight is that when your identity is completely liquefied, sometimes we really struggle with the question of, you know, so who am I? Deep down inside, who am I? And what is related to our identity is our very kind of purpose in life and the meaning that we make of the world around us. And we know that meaning and purpose are essential kind of to survival and understanding who we are. So today, sometimes in liquid modernity, we sort of frantically try to put together and piece together our identity to try to like get that sort of melted liquid to sort of solidify into an ice cube again so I can stand firm on an identity. Well, what happens many times is that we will latch on to a particular group or a particular way of thinking or particular philosophy, and we will utilize that to form our identity. And because our identities are fragile, we might hold on to it much stronger than we maybe necessarily should. We might become rigid in our thinking. We might become somewhat more rigid in our rejection kind of the outsider or anything that challenges that identity. Well, if that's kind of the general picture, that whole picture of liquid modernity in which we live, we can then see how the political situation in which we have could be, in a sense, become intensified in terms of its negativity. So I choose my Republican identity, for instance, and all of these other identities in my life, which are somewhat fragile, but which I'm trying to hold on to, for instance, might be my racial identity, might be my religious identity, might be my geographical identity. All of those are now aligned perfectly, which is called a mega identity, with the Republican identity that I am choosing. Well, I hold on to that, and it's giving me life, it's giving me meaning, it's giving me purpose, and it's doing so in an already kind of fragile world. So then if I see another group which does not have hardly any of those shared identities within it, namely like a more progressive group, which happens to sort of occupy a sort of different racial demographic and, again, a different religious demographic, that can become a much greater threat to me. And so when we move into an election cycle, it is the case today that when we cast a vote, people will argue, particularly Liliana Mason, for instance, in her research, she says, when we vote, we're not just voting for a political party or a political candidate. We are voting to shore up all of our identity markers, and it's already taking place in a very fragile world, which we feel kind of that fragility in reference to our identity. So every election then seems like the most important election going forward because we're voting to shore up our identity.
You know, speaking of identity, certainly on the left, there is a very strong movement to identify gender, orientation, etc. And I understand that so many people have lived as marginalized lives that now this is the time to come out of the shadows and say, this is who I am. But and I've cranked enough about the right so far. I'm going to do a little cranking on the left. for instance, I was involved in a project with the ACLU. And this was during COVID, and so all of our meetings were on Zoom. And we were instructed at the beginning of the meeting to have our names listed along with our preferred pronouns. I'm fine with calling anybody whatever they want to be called, he, she, it, they, fine. But I shouldn't have to be told to provide my preferred pronoun. Maybe I don't prefer pronouns at all. Maybe I don't like pronouns to begin with. Don't call me anything. I just never did that. That was my silent protest. I put my name up, and I never put my preferred pronouns. And you know what? Nobody ever got it wrong. It's just amazing. They always seem to guess right. But again, I can understand because you have this whole population that has been living in the shadows, underserved, under misunderstood. And so now they're raising their flag. I get it. But again, it shouldn't be a required performance to join the tribe, shall we say, if I can put it that way. One other thing I wanted to ask you, David French, you quote him in your book, and he says that GOP Latinos and gays shed their identity as being gay or Latino, and Democrats shed their faith. And I'm not sure I agree with that. Maybe you know of examples, because I think as we go on, that more and more liberal Democrats are saying, this is who I am. I am a Christian. I am a Jew. Here in Michigan, there was a very proud Hindu running for office and never shied away from that. So I'm curious if you think that that's still a thing, that people are shedding their identities, and especially with the GOP, if they're now courting Latinos, why wouldn't they encourage their candidates to say, hey, I'm Republican and I'm a Latino. Hey, I'm Republican and I'm gay. I think George Santos did that, or whatever his name really is.
Yeah, and I think you're touching on an important issue that I try to highlight in the book. And I think one of the things to, at least for all of us to sort of reflect upon and highlight, is that when we form groups, and our political groups would be one of the main groups that exist, we fear at a psychological level ostracization. And again, this goes back to kind of evolutionary psychology, that groups were necessary for us for survival. And so there's mechanisms within us which tell us, like, if our membership in a group is being threatened, well, you need to do something to fix that, right? Because you want to replenish your membership, as they say, in order to protect your membership within that group, because that ultimately would, in a sense, bring about your most likelihood to survive. So that being the case, there are all kinds of psychological studies that show that when we feel we're being ostracized, or when we feel like we don't fit in within a group, we will do all kinds of different things in order to replenish group membership. So one of them is we will mimic the majority of the group. So we will mimic them in mannerisms, for instance. We will also, it's called groupthink, you know, so we will also, in a sense, cave to the thinking of the group. Again, statistically speaking, we'd be more likely to cave to the thinking of the group. And also we'll kind of hide identities of ours if we don't feel like they fit within the group. Now, that being said, you know, so that's kind of established in psychological and evolutionary psychological research. That being said, as there are kind of shifting realities within these political mega groups, I think it will depend on, you know, what identities people will hide, or what identities will come to the front. And it's always going to depend on sort of what is accepted by, or what is at least perceived to be accepted by, the majority of the group. And so it really just depends on kind of what is the makeup of the group, and what do we feel will help us not to become ostracized within any group we're in.
We just have a couple of minutes to go, Father. I'm curious about your order. It's called the Glenmary Home Missioners. So you do all of your work at home, like all of your work's on Zoom. You don't have to go anywhere?
Oh, that's great.
No.
for a while, of course, that's what we were doing, right?
Yes.
Our community was founded back in 1939, and it was done so by a diocesan priest by the name of Father William Howard Bishop. And at that time in the United States, there were missionary orders in the Catholic Church that were sending missionaries all over the world, in particular, like to Latin America, to China, to the continent of Africa, for instance. And he recognized that there were kind of whole vast regions in the United States that really had very few Catholics and was really underserved by the Catholic Church. And those happened to be kind of deep regions throughout Appalachia, throughout the Southeast and kind of the historically sort of more Protestant areas of the South. So he actually felt he received this charism from the Holy Spirit to found a community that focused on home, and that is that focused on what was his home and the home, which is the United States. And so he founded this community of priests, brothers, sisters, and lay people. And since 1939, Glenmary has been going to counties throughout rural America where there's really no established or formal Catholic population. And then we go into the area and we work with the people who are there. We build relationships. We share in life with them. We dialogue with them. What we do theologically, we say we try to bring about the kingdom of God. And we also look to establishing a Catholic presence if seems like it's an interest to the people there or if it's what God desires for the area.
Father Westman, thank you so very much for your time today and last week as well.
Thank you so much, Fred. It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to Common Threads, and my name is Fred Stella. We've been speaking with Father Aaron Westman about his book, The Church's Mission in a Polarized World. Please join us again next week here on WGVU-FM.
Common Threads is a production of WGVU in cooperation with the Interfaith Dialogue Association. The views and opinions expressed are not necessarily those of the station, its underwriters, or Grand Valley State University. In many cases, the participants on this program represent themselves and may not be designated spokespeople for the faiths they represent. Send questions and comments by email through our website, www.interfaithdialogueassociation.org. Thank you for listening and join us again next week for another edition of Common Threads.